Hey, welcome to another week of Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. I'm Lauren Fox.
And I'm Andrew Hansen.
And I just turned up the headphones, and that's a good thing.
Just in time.
Yeah, because I was like, wow, I'm really soft and quiet. So,
Is that your notepad?
That's mine. It's a Dunkin' Donuts bag. I got an apple fritter in it earlier this morning. It was delicious.
Now it's your show outline?
Now it's the outline of the first segment.
Is there, like, 12 words on there?
Maybe 17, maybe. It might be a haiku. So the first thing it says is how the show works.
Oh, how does the show work?
That's a good question. If we don't have interview subjects, or even if we do, typically what will happen is you send me a list of topics that I know nothing about.
Right.
I attempt to do as much research as I can so that I am at least conversant in what we're talking about, because otherwise I might as well be speaking French, and I don't speak French. And then we talk about them, and usually we wind up going in other directions about 14 times. Then,
well, I try to make it easier for you by providing links.
Links are good. Yeah.
I don't just name a topic and say, go research it, Lauren.
I don't just have to Google and then wind up getting something completely wrong. But yeah, it's, fortunately, I'm not researching it, because there's a lot of bad information out there on the internet, as we all know. But, and then the next part of it is how I break the show. Which is what I'm about to do.
Okay.
So, sports. Like, we are in the middle of a playoff run in the men's softball league.
Yes.
We can interview each other if after that's done. That'd be entertaining to us, but really nobody else. But what sort of superstitions do you have?
Or did you have? This show's only an hour long.
Really that many?
Yeah.
Okay, give me your top three.
Top three would be... Well, let's just look at baseball, since we're talking about baseball and softball.
I mean, I will say, because having played with you basketball, softball, you have routines.
Yes.
They are, and don't mess with Hansen's routines.
No. So, unless
there's poker before the game, in which case, all bets literally are off.
Well, you switch the routine, so that on those occasions, you stretch earlier. You stretch at home at 6:30 to 7.
You're stretching in the poker table at the poker table.
Yeah, okay. In between hands.
Okay, so half hour of stretching.
It doesn't need to be a half hour. It's about 10 to 15 minutes of warm up. So it's a little bit different for each sport, but for basketball, that is one superstition. It's the same warm up, the running, the stretching. Got to get the body loose and ready for action.
Yep.
So that's one superstition. Number two for baseball would be putting on the uniform the same way.
Okay.
You got to go right sock, left sock, etc.
Huh. Okay.
And then baseball, my big one in college was I would always have a bite of a balance bar before each at bat.
Okay.
So it was sort of like get a little bit of energy, have a little bit of a superstition to get my mind into the at bat, and you'll cherish it.
Yeah.
Focus on it.
Okay.
One bite, one at bat.
What if you're hungrier?
Well, you got to eat throughout the day properly,
okay,
knowing when the game is.
What if the game goes long, extra innings?
There's no extra balance bar.
Tiny bite?
It's possible.
Okay.
You can do a tiny bite.
All right.
Yep.
Balance bar. Do you still do that, though?
No. I mean, I haven't seen a balance bar in about 10 years.
Because, I mean, I don't know. There are certain things that I will do as far as baseball / softball goes. I'm never quite early enough to do.
Oh, you mean when you pulled in 2 minutes early last night, that you didn't that to give you time for any routines?
I had to drive to Hooks It and pick one of my kids up at gymnastics. I had three throws. Actually, that's a lie. I had one throw before the game started.
And it was on the diamond to me.
It was
right?
On the diamond to you.
As you were headed to the outfield.
As I was headed to the outfield. But
so that didn't really look like a normal routine.
No, but I mean, I knock wood. I've always been lucky in that I can just, it doesn't take me much to warm up. Like,
right.
I'm usually fairly loose as far as throwing goes. Case in point, last weekend we're in Cooperstown, and they have the little double day batting range right in the parking lot of Double Day Field, and they have a speed pitch, and I'm like, all right, let's go. I'm going to do this. And I'm trying to beat the over 40 for the day. And I did beat the over 40 for the day, but I'm trying to beat now a threshold, and I'm throwing basically right up to the threshold, no warmups. So then the next morning, Maggie and I go out to Double Day. We're throwing for a little bit. Her team arrives. I go into the batting range. I'm like, all right, I'm ready. I'm loose. I hit the exact same number after warming up for 10 minutes that I did cold.
And we should share the number, because it was shocking.
69 miles an hour. That's it. I mean,
from a guy who has a strong arm.
Yeah,
I mean, you see your throws around the softball field, and you have a strong arm.
I think it might have been low, but, you know, hey.
The gun was certainly, it may have been capped at 69.
No, because there were others that were in the 80s and 90s, okay. Allegedly. I didn't see anybody throw higher than that. But,
wow.
Yeah. There's also,
I would have predicted you at least 74, 75.
There are radar guns on Back River Road. And I'm considering driving out there and using it as my personal speed pitch.
Yep.
Like Jim Morris and the Rookie. But anyway, we've like digressed now. I don't like my superstitions involve more things like, you know, you think about sports things, playoff beard. I can't do that. I get too itchy, not to mention I can't really grow facial hair in spite of being in the mid 40s. Not washing uniforms. Like
Yes. That I remember. I've seen you do that.
Right.
Which is, this whole thing is interesting to me because when you ask about superstitions and I can go into routines, which you've seen
yeah.
and you know,
yeah.
for you, I don't see a routine for you pregame. it's very loosey-goosey, show up, have some fun, and get going.
They're usually things that are required to do, usually somewhere along the lines. It's put contacts in, put your shoes on, crack a beer. Like, not necessarily in that order, but...
Yeah, so your superstitions can't be routines. It has to be something else.
I don't have washing the uniform. Not washing the uniform, which is like a harkening back to Dirty Al Gallagher, who 25-game win streak, 25-game hit streak, didn't wash his Santa Clara uniform in college, and that's how he earned that nickname, and literally earned it. Fortunately, our season doesn't go 25 games, or the playoffs don't go 25 games, so I can just let it ride and know that best case scenario, I'll wear it twice more and I'll just leave it to air dry. But the other thing, so I was listening to, if anybody's heard of Tim Ferriss, the 4-Hour Workweek guy, I was listening to one of his podcasts a few weeks ago and I can't remember who was on it with him, but the long and the short of it is this is a guy who's been a world champion in a variety of disciplines. And it's not like he's the world 100-meter track sprinting champion and the world's 100-meter butterfly champion. It's not disciplines like that that are vastly different. These are like martial arts disciplines that I'm sure to the trained eye are different, but to the rest of us, I look and I go, well, that's kind of a niche thing and that's kind of a niche thing. But regardless, there's 7 billion people in the world. You're number one. I mean, that's...
So he's an expert in multiple martial arts?
He's an expert in... it's just a bunch of different disciplines, some of which involve martial arts, some of which... are not necessarily hand-to-hand fighting, but some are, it's more of the, as a non-karate person, I'll describe it as just breaking things. Like, he's not necessarily, it's not like, you know, Thunderdome or Two Men Enter, One Man Leave or anything like that. It's more of the things that require mental focus, where you're given a score and graded against other people. But one of the things that this guy talked about, and I think we've all done it to some sort of a degree, is he was talking about people who are peak performers who basically this guy's kind of theory when you get into the peak performance stuff is you can't be at 60% all the time in your life. Because if you're at 60% all the time, you find it way harder to get to 100%. So you need tricks that will get you from zero, which is like a resting state, to 100 for whenever your performance state is back down to a zero state. So you're conserving energy because if you're at 60 all the time, you're blowing through a lot of energy and you're never quite getting to 100. And some of the tricks that some of these world champions use are they'll nap. They take like an 8-minute power nap and somebody will grab them and say, hey, you're in the ring in 2 minutes. And then boom, they do what they need to do and they're ready to go. But they're refreshed. And it's not like they've been sleeping for 8 hours. They sleep for 8 minutes and they recharge. One other thing that he brought up was music and the ability to use certain songs within training as a way to get your basically trick yourself into getting into a peak state. When I was running long distance and running races, my go-to was Eminem. Like if I needed to break through something, that would be it. And I would, you know, we had a text string going, a bunch of us ran a half a few years ago. And we'd all send paces and distances and whatever. And the joke was that I would run angry, but I was listening to that and I would get to that point and I would basically be running angry. There are some songs that as you sit there and, you know, they, all right, now this becomes a superstition of I'm driving to the field or I'm driving to the court. I need to listen to this. So you said you haven't really done a whole lot of that since high school.
Yes. Back in the day when I was younger, that was much more of a part of my routine. In the Little League All-Stars, it was We Are the Champions. That
Queen.
Was,
there yeah. you go.
And then when it got into junior high school basketball, my song was Kickstart My Heart.
Yep. Which is about a drug overdose. Yes.
Yes.
But, you know, that's the stuff, as we discussed off air, that you don't quite know.
At that age.
At that
it's
age.
It's just the sound of it, the intensity.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, it definitely takes you to the next level, gets you fired up. And whatever it is that it just locks you in, then you feel good that you've completed your routine, not to mention you're more energetic and ready to perform.
Right. It's sort of whatever gets you started to go. You know, and so for me this year, for whatever reason, there are some songs that, hey, this happens to be playing. And there's a song that happened to be playing on Tuesday as we're driving to the game. I'm like, okay, that's great. Listening to the live version, I have the studio version in my phone, so I finish the live version, throw the studio version on. Then Thursday, driving to the field, it happens to be on again.
Wow. And this is the stuff of
right
great lore.
I mean, it's what happens when you're listening to XM. Like, if you're listening to these really tight stations, like, if it's, you know, nobody's using the Grateful Dead as a pump up, but if you're listening to the Grateful Dead station, you're going to get, as vast as their catalog is, you're going to get a lot of things that just sort of repeat over time. But yeah, it's going back to what Ken Revisa, sports psychologist, would talk about. It's the how do you get into the peak state? And it is having a routine. It is having, I know it because you hit right after me. I see your pre-at-bat routine, which doesn't really waver. Mine doesn't really waver. It's like, it's kind of the three bears, you know, it's the, I want to have not too little and not too much time. Like, it's the, how do you find the balance of I'm not waiting around versus I'm also not rushed, which it's, you know, it's a challenge, but I don't know. I can only imagine what guys and women at the highest level do in order to get there.
Well, you think back to Wade Boggs.
7-17.
Everything was sevens.
Yeah. Chicken
every day. And then everything on sevens in terms of when do you step onto the field for batting practice? When does he take BP?
He even drank 107 Miller Lights in a cross-country flight. Wade Boggs did.
Yeah, that's a different story entirely.
No, I can't remember who it was with Wade Boggs. I actually messed with the clock, so it went from whatever, 6:16 to 6:18 or something like that.
Not good.
Yeah. But
you don't do that to an AL batting champ.
Yeah.
If you want him to stay in peak performance.
AL tastes great, less filling champ would be the real thing. And a star of 80s sitcom Cheers.
Yeah.
So now that I've broken the show for about, 14 minutes, give or take, now we can talk about real things. So you sent me over something about golf. I didn't even look at it. I was busy falling down the stairs.
Well, let's start with.
You think I'm joking? I'm not.
We're going to get into some fun stats, but let's talk about the final tournament of the year, the Tour Championship, because it had a new format this year where instead of it being FedEx Cup points, and it had evolved to the point where the only thing you knew heading into the Tour Championship, where there's only 30 players, is that if you go in the top five and you win, then you were going to win the FedEx Cup and get the $10 million bonus.
Yep.
This year they changed it. And they said, you know what, we're not going to do that because it's too hard to follow for the fans. So we're going to make it so that all of your season points end up to a ranking system. But then when you get to the final tournament, you have an advantage in strokes. So Justin Thomas starts off the tournament 10 under because he's number one in points.
Huh, okay.
And then next on the list, Patrick Cantlay was 8 under.
So it's like having a handicap, basically.
It's like having a handicap. So he was up by...
Except it's backwards.
It's backwards.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's up by 2. Koepka was in 3rd at 7 under. Rory was at 5 under. And it goes all the way down to even par. So it's it's the first time they've done this. Lots of discussion about the format. Do we like it? How is it going to play out? I thought it was great because you take away this points thing where you're following two different things. You're following a leaderboard and you're following the FedEx Cup points. And now it's just, okay, you give Justin Thomas the 2-stroke advantage because he's earned it. And now you go play. And the other thing they did was they increased the prize this year to $15 million. So
that's good because I know a lot of golfers are short on cash and struggling to get by. So I'm really excited that the prize for winning a golf tournament is $15 million.
Yeah,
that's good.
Well, that leads into one of the stats, which is how many golfers on the PGA Tour this year made $1 million. And this is trivia time for Lauren.
220, 221, whatever it takes.
Well, think of it as, remember, 125 guys get their card automatically based on standings. So
83.
112.
Okay. So basically, by getting a PGA Tour card, you have a 90% chance that you're going to make $1 million.
Right. That's where we are today.
So
thanks to Eldrick. So that's stat number one.
Wow. So your chances, if you're, I don't know about the percentage of the world that golfs, but your chances of being a millionaire in any given year because of golfing are so tiny, like comically tiny.
But you're right. If you're on the PGA Tour,
0.000016%.
Right. But if you're on the tour, it's well over 50%. So the challenge is just getting there.
Right. Yes.
So that was the format. And what was interesting about it was, now, for the first time, you've got a guy who's sitting on the lead for not just one or two nights heading into Sunday thinking about, oh, if I win this, I can win $15 million. Justin Thomas was sitting on the lead for like 4 or 5 days heading into the tournament. And I think it wore him down because over the course of the tournament, he only shot 3 under, went from first to third, tied for third. So instead of winning first place in $15 million, he only came away with $3.5 million. So he lost $11.5 million in the standings based on his performance.
Hmm. You know, another fun fact about Justin Thomas that is if you took 5 dudes dressed in the same thing and said and put them in a police lineup and said, identify which one's Justin Thomas, I would just shake my head and walk out.
Well,
I have no idea what he looks like.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. None.
Well, he would not stand out physically like Koepka because Justin Thomas is like 5'10", 170.
So right. So he's like a skinnier
version
golfer. Of me.
Right.
Yes.
So he doesn't stand out, but he did stand out with his performance this year.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing about the Tour Championship is that Tiger was not there. Phil was not there.
Yes.
Even though they had both won during the season. So that's another controversy of how they're awarding points. Tiger wins a major, doesn't finish in the top 30. Phil wins, doesn't finish in the top 30.
Do you get a tan jacket like they did in Happy Gilmore, like Shooter got?
For winning the Tour Championship?
Yes.
No, I forget what the trophy is.
They don't
is.
Get jacket? I mean, you couldn't get like the Century 21 blazer?
I can't recall what the special trophy is, but the thing about the Phil and Tiger not being there is that you're missing those big names. The final pairing on Sunday ended up being Rory McIlroy and Brooks Koepka.
Oh, wow.
So
okay.
The next question for you is, what do you think about that final pairing for the PGA Tour, you know, wanting eyeballs, wanting interest? Where would you rank that on what you would want the dream final pairing to be as you chase for $15 million?
It's pretty close. I mean, the better final pairing, like, you want guys who are household names. You want guys who are one-name guys. And I think Brooks and Rory, or Koepka, as it
Bruce.
Were. Bruce is a one-name guy. No, Bruce is a one-name guy. No, Koepka, you know, because that's...
Koepka.
Everybody refers to him as that. Koepka and Rory are one-name guys. Tiger and Phil are one-name guys. Justin and... I don't know. I mean...
Hideki?
Those are not one-name guys to most people.
Justin,
so
he's a two-initial guy, JT.
He is a two-initial guy, but I feel like there are about 17 guys on the tour named Justin. It's like my 10-year-old has 4 kids named Grace and 3 kids named Jacob in her class. It's like there are just some names that tend to recur, and I feel like half the tour, honestly, is named Justin. And maybe it's because Justin Thomas played so well this year and I kept hearing about him. I'm not certain.
Justin Leonard.
He hasn't been around in a while, has he?
Well, he's announcing now, so you see him and hear him a little bit.
But wow.
Yeah, I think the other names you might want in a final pairing would be guys like Ricky Fowler.
Ricky Fowler would be a good one because, I mean, he really, to me, is the Maria Sharapova of golf, where, like, she for so long was doing, what, Canon commercials and everything else. Ricky Fowler has gotten to a point where now he's doing Rocket Mortgage. He's like, he is a really marketable dude, and deservedly so. Like, he's a charismatic guy. Seems like he'd really be a fun guy to hang out with. So, like, I look at that and I say, all right, that makes sense. But he hasn't won a major yet.
Right.
It would be nice. Like, I think if he were to be in contention on the final day, it wouldn't be like a Tiger-esque, like, I need to get to a TV and turn it on. But I think people would be excited about it.
Definitely.
The tour would be excited
right,
about it.
Right, exactly. Then the other golfer who I would like to watch if I couldn't have Koepka, Rory, Tiger, Phil would be Dustin Johnson. Just because the way that he plays the game is so fun to watch. Beautiful swing, crushes the ball. When he's on, he really makes it look easy. But I thought of the guys who were there, that was a really great final pairing to watch. I think they're the two best players in the world and different styles. You know, Koepka's power, Rory just such a beautiful swing. So they're entertaining to watch golf-wise.
Yep.
So Rory was the one who finished it off and was clutch on the back nine when Koepka surprisingly faltered, and Rory took home $15 million. So on the year, he earned about $24 million playing golf.
Good year.
Not a bad year. So let's get into some of these stats.
Okay.
All right. So Matthew Wolf is a rookie on tour. He hot star out of college. He won for the first time this summer. When he was born, how many wins do you think Phil Mickelson had?
Good gracious. Phil, I'm looking at the clock.
He's looking at the clock.
But I'm like attempting,
ironically,
I'm
this is where,
attempting to do math. How many wins would I think Phil Mickelson had 23 years ago? Four.
He already had 13 wins.
What?
When Matthew Wolf was born.
But he had not won a major yet because he had the mantle of best player never to win a major for a while.
Next one. How many one putts in a row would you need to make to feel like, wow, I just had a really hot streak of putting?
One.
Come on. That's not
one
a streak.
And a half. Two.
All right. So what do you think was the longest such streak on tour this year?
Oh, gracious. 10?
17.
Holy, really?
17 one putts or better. So if he chips in, you know, that counts as one.
Who had that?
Brian Stewart. Just a run-of-the-mill average golfer who probably made $1 million.
And he shot an 83 that day?
No.
He was just having a really hard time with
his
irons.
Can you imagine 17 holes in a row with one putt or less?
Yeah.
Wow. Longest putt on tour this year.
Holes in one don't count?
Correct.
Okay.
This is a putt.
82 feet.
85.8.
What's the longest one you've ever made?
I'm going to say probably like 65, 70 feet.
I made a 78-foot one once. When
did
I was golfing a lot.
Wow, that sounds like a very precise measurement.
Well, no, I stepped it off, so I wasn't, you know, you're assuming, all right,
every average step
is a yard, give or take. Yeah. But, I mean, it was like one of those joke things. When I golf, and I use that in air quotes, when I golf, I putt cross-handed.
Okay.
And in that instance, because I was so far away, you can't putt cross-handed without, like, you need to get something on it. If you're cross-handed, you really have no power. So I hit that one regular style and somehow got it to go in from 78 feet.
But you went back to cross-handed?
Well, no.
You're draining 78 footers and you're like, nah, I don't really want to putt with this grip.
All you're trying to do from 78 feet is give yourself a close second putt.
That's true.
It's like Romo mode.
Unless your name is Brian Stewart and you just make everything.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So what do you think is the best percentage of making 5 footers and in? So over the course of the season, you're hitting all these 3, 4, 5 footers. What would be best percentage on tour that you might predict?
I'm going to guess it's like an extra point in the NFL, 98.
John Rahm, 98.42%.
Yep.
That'd be good for one day in my mind.
Yeah.
To do it for a season.
Yeah, but you sit there. Okay, so again, in the digesting of information that other people create department, I'm reading a book right now called Grit, which is talking about what sort of separates people that are great or that are leaders from the rest of us. And there is a lot of self-awareness among that group of people. And a lot of it stems from not practicing what you're good at, but from practicing like having a degree of self-awareness where you can sit back and say, okay, this is what I need to work on. And then you go and work on it. And the things that you suck at aren't the fun things to work at. The things that you're not good at are hard to work at and oftentimes require you breaking things apart. And don't think, I mean, John Rahm's making, you said 98, he's making the human temperature of putts, 98.4. Don't think with that guy that's not something that he has spent countless hours on. This isn't he just rolled out of bed and was a better putter than everybody else. That's a work. That is a statistic that is derived from him saying, this is going to be how I'm going to separate myself. And there he is.
And, you know, it's funny because the next stat I have is somebody who did this, Webb Simpson. He was not a strong putter. He was a below average putter on tour, went back to the drawing board, worked really hard on it. And now he came up with the longest streak of greens with not having a three putt. So for most amateurs, if you go 18 holes without a three putt, you're pretty happy. All right. You know, I had a good putting day, just ones and two putts.
If I go 18 holes without an eight.
Yeah. So what do you think the streak would be for this pro, best pro at avoiding three putts? How many holes in a row without a three putt?
I'm going to guess it's in the 60s, 62.
62 holes?
Yeah.
So you're looking at like four rounds?
Three and a half rounds.
He went 20 rounds without a three putt. 361 holes.
Wow.
Is that one of the PGA Tour slogans? These guys are good?
Yeah, that's just ungodly.
Wow.
Like, so, really, all it takes to not be able to do that is you give yourself a 20-footer with a slightly bad read, and you leave yourself an 8-footer that's unmakeable.
Yeah, 8-footer coming back.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, oh, crap. But the thing that I take from that stat is 361 holes, like, mentally, you're not taking any time off. You are checked in on literally every time you step onto that green. You are completely checked in and ready to roll. That, to me,
things that John Daly has never done.
That is testament to this guy's complete mental focus. It is hard to do. I'm confident, literally now, confident that if you took me on the course and said, try to play three holes without three putting, it wouldn't happen.
Well, speaking of focus, how about best percentage on three-footers and in this season?
I mean, obviously, if somebody's 98-4, somebody's got to be, you know, Ivory Soap, 99 and 44 hundredths.
Brant Snedeker.
Sneds.
Sneds, a perfect 834 for 834. Didn't miss a three-footer.
Good gracious. Wow.
And that's not, if you had to pick somebody, that's not really surprising. He's known as an excellent putter.
That would have been the first one I would have thought of course.
And last stat of the day here. Longest drive on tour this year in yardage?
Deuce and a half. 392.
457.
You're lying.
It was in Mexico, so I think there was some altitude
to
play.
Oh, Mexico.
But it was the guy who we started this discussion about, talking about, Justin Thomas.
Really?
The 5'10", 170 guy, hit one 457 down in Mexico.
Wow.
There you have it.
That's legit. So, all right. Now we can talk about golf without the L.
Yes, we can.
Coco Golf.
Yep.
See what I did? As a Caddyshack reference. And now we're talking about the U.S. Open. That's the only reason I wanted to do that. No, we were sitting there watching her on SportsCenter this morning.
15-year-old.
And I'm sitting there with my kids who are 13 and 10. And we're talking about, all right, first of all, the fact that she's playing in front of all these people. And second of all, that she's not terribly fazed by it. And, like, how do you prepare yourself when you're 15 years old to be that?
I think you just have to have the mentality of, I'm just going to go out and have fun. You know, use your confidence. Hey, I've already won in Grand Slams before, and just go out and let it ride and try and play free.
That's what she's doing, and it's a blast to watch. She plays hard. She's got a good power game, and she has a name that's easy to chant. And I just, you know, you get a kick out of, all right, here is Venus and Serena are not getting any younger, although Serena may be getting younger. I mean, they're both playing very well. The outside of them, the next echelon of American tennis has been sort of hit or miss. It's been inconsistent. And it's good to see that the younger end of things is now sort of pushing in and maybe ready to assume the mantle of women's tennis in America. So, I don't know. It's and the U.S. Open's the greatest place to do it. Like, that, I'm not the biggest tennis fan, but you give me a tennis major and you put it on TV, I will absolutely watch it, because watching tennis players as athletes, I think the women's tennis game is a way more watchable game than the men's.
Yeah, it is fun to watch. The U.S. Open has its own unique personality, and you got the late night tennis, you got the New York fans getting into it. It is a fun spectacle. The one thing I didn't like about the women's draw this year was that they pitted Sharapova against Serena in the first round.
Yeah.
Which I think is just, it's unfair to both of them, because what is it? It's to get ratings, get interest in the first round, but you're having a former Grand Slam winner automatically get knocked out in the first round just so you can get some interest in the first round?
Sharapova won a Grand Slam?
She had to have. No? How about tennis star and Grand Slam semifinalist?
Yes.
Okay.
And maybe, I honestly don't know. She did win Wimbledon in 2004 and the French in 2012 and 2014.
She won those?
Yeah.
Okay. So Grand Slam winner.
Yeah.
And what I don't like the seeding for women's tennis or men's tennis for that matter in these Grand Slams. How is Serena ever less than a 2 or 3 seed? I think she's an 8 seed this year. She's been a 17 seed in the last couple of years at a major.
And this is what I don't know because I'm not as close of a follower of tennis. Where I tend to get lost is seeding and how much goes on by a computer and how much goes on by an actual human of saying, yeah, I don't like this first round draw. Shuffle the deck here.
Too much human involvement.
Okay.
Yeah.
So why would you then have Sharapova taking on Serena in the first round?
Just for ratings. It's the only explanation.
Okay. For ratings and to get people talking about the tournament early.
Yeah.
But you have Coco. Reasons that people will be talking about it.
But you don't know that she's going to get to the third round.
I wonder what Jennifer Capriati's up to. What do you think Maria Sharapova's career winnings are?
25 million.
You underbid by about 13.
Okay.
$38 million. So, yeah. That's impressive. It's a lot of cash money in the bank. So, all right. Let's
take a break, come back, about some other women athletes and some football.
Yes, and then perhaps I can also share some other bad ideas that I have.
Okay.
I really appreciate, our listeners never tell me about it, whether they like it or not, but I get to share all my bad ideas on the air. So anyway, you're listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Welcome back to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. I think this is show 93, is that right?
I think you're right.
So we should probably get to 100 and then rename it.
Okay.
I don't know what we'll call it, but something. I don't know. It needs a new identity. So with that being said, that was just like complete.
Was that your bad idea?
No, that was just an idea. Okay. I hadn't thought about it until I started saying it. And I don't know. Anyway, what was our next topic?
Bad ideas from Lauren?
Yeah, no, that's, I could go on for hours. Yeah.
Let's mention a little bit of preseason Bedford football talk.
Yes.
Because we're taping this on Friday.
Yes.
We may be broadcasting the Jamboree this evening, final preseason game for Bedford.
You'll be there. I can't guarantee that I'll be there.
Right.
But
either way, season opener is next Friday, the 6th.
Yep.
So exciting times because Bedford's coming off a state championship, undefeated season.
Yes.
But they lost a lot of their offensive production. So it's a big challenge for the new coach, Zach Matthews. Obviously, some of the stars that y'all got used to watching and hearing about last year, the quarterback Thomas Morgan,
yep.
Running back Ryan Toscano, Harry Leguillon.
Yep.
And then the kicker, Matty Lucantoni, who we've had on the show multiple times.
Yep.
So, skill positions, it's going to be a big challenge.
It always is. I mean, it's with any four-year program, whether it's college or high school, that is always the challenge of, how do you reload? I mean, the players that are getting the first team reps are the ones that are getting first team reps. They're the ones who are getting the opportunity to get better as they go. That really is the biggest challenge, that you have other people that are waiting in the wings and might not be playing as much. And so there might be bumps in the road. And the thing that you didn't even, you alluded to it, but you didn't go full bore on it, is Coach Stank is gone. He's at not necessarily greener pastures, but he's at a better climate and closer to the ocean.
What do you know about that?
Yeah, it's San Marcos High School out in California. That's where Derek Stank is now. And Coach Matthews has come to Bedford from Kearsarge. But for him, it's not like he was handed a full cabinet and said, all right, go with this. He's got a lot of really good parts that have departed, and he's got a team that's raw, and we'll have him on at some point in the not distant future at all. But what what you're hoping for if you're him is, okay, if, you know, you realize you're probably not going to go undefeated. You had a well-appointed team last year. Going undefeated may not happen, although there are some very strong players on that team. What do you learn from the losses that you have during the season? How do you make the right choices with the players who are going to ultimately lead you there? And how do you make it so that regardless of how the regular season goes, when playoff time comes, your team is running on all cylinders, so to speak?
Right. And you've hit it on the nose with these challenges facing Coach Matthews. The one nice thing that Coach Stank did, along with leading this team to a very successful season, was Coach Stank got a lot of the backups in for at least a quarter or more in a lot of the games last season. You know, they were fortunate enough to have big leads at halftime, and so he would rest the starters, you know, sometimes during the third quarter, certainly by the beginning of the fourth. So a lot of these, you know, sophomores and juniors got a lot of playing time on the field last year, so at least Coach Matthews has that.
Right, and yes, that makes a difference, but getting into a game when you're up 28-0, 35-0 is a different scenario than getting into a game that is nothing-nothing and being played at full game speed. Because as much as anybody wants to tell you that if you're up or down by four or five touchdowns, you're playing the exact same way as you would if it were a tie game, yeah, you can try to play that way, but most of us have a hard time focusing when there is that kind of a lead taking place in the game, and expecting that a high school student on either side of the football is going to be completely locked in is unrealistic. It may be that what I'll say is it's good that the players have had the opportunity to get in front of a big crowd at home in Bedford. That's a good thing, because it mitigates a lot of the jitters of, I've never been in front of a crowd this large, I've never played in front of a group this large. But as far as the speed of the game, as far as the defenses that you're seeing, that sort of stuff will change. Particularly this program, after having won the state title last year, it has a target on its back.
It does. And you're right. Being in that 28-0, 35-0 lead, it is a lot different. And not to mention the play calling is different.
Yep, absolutely.
You know, the Bedford coaching staff would be much more conservative and call a lot more running plays in those scenarios last season, not to run up the score. So we're excited to look forward to the season and, you know, get to know some of these players that are going to fill into those positions. And one of the ones we mentioned, of course, is the kicking position, where Maddie really mastered the physical and mental challenges of that position. I believe she went 4-for-4 on extra points in the state championship game, had a great percentage on field goals and extra points throughout the season. It's interesting because one of the big pieces of news from the end of NFL preseason was the surprise kicking appearance that Carly Lloyd made at the Eagles and Ravens practice. This is the U.S. World Cup women's soccer star, 37 years old, and she shows up at an NFL training camp and boots a 55-yard field goal right through the uprights.
And then proceeds to score a goal against Portugal last night in a friendly.
Yeah, so, just, you know, that's her August.
Yeah, so, you know, there a lot of people have now chimed in on this because this is what everybody does, and I guess this is what we're doing to a degree, and are looking at it like, could a woman kick in the NFL? She made a 55-yard field goal. Was her form NFL ready yet? No. The end result was NFL ready. Like, you hear about a 55-yard field goal, and you're thinking about somebody kicking this thing with low trajectory that's going to get blocked. That wasn't what she kicked at all.
No.
I mean, this was a legit field goal that would have cleared a defensive line. The only thing that if you're looking at it, the only thing that's funky is her run-up was a little bit longer than it would have needed to be, and that would have cost her in the NFL. But as far as leg strength, she absolutely has it. And so then you have, and Harry will appreciate this, Stephen Hauschka, Bills kicker, comes out and says, yeah, I think she could definitely kick in the NFL, and I'd be happy to work on it with her to help her get here, which, hey, that's in order for it to happen, it's going to be way easier to have somebody who's been there, done that, helping her to get to the next level. It will have to be, it's like anybody who's a pioneer in any sport. You have to be able to tune everything else out while you're focusing on your task at hand. I don't think it's a fair comparison to say it's like Jackie Robinson in baseball, but what made Jackie Robinson so great at what he did was his ability to get onto the field and tune out every racial slur, everything, and just go and play his game the best that he could, and use his unique combination of intelligence and competitiveness and desire and athleticism to make himself into one of the best ball players, if not in that era, ever. So for her, the challenges are going to be a little bit different. He didn't have to deal with talk radio back then. He didn't have to deal with an internet back then where seemingly people sit and wait until there's a nice story out there. And immediately the first thing they do when there's a good story about somebody is, all right, how can I tear this person down? Because I've seen it enough times with my daughter, with the girls' baseball stuff, where somebody puts up a picture of so-and-so who's going to play in college somewhere, and I'm going to say 3/4 of the people are congratulatory, and the other quarter of people are seemingly waiting for that opportunity to take something that somebody's achieved and accomplished, and from the comfort of their couch, which they're not getting up off to do anything, they're tearing the other person's accomplishments down. That's really what the internet has provided us, is the ability to be keyboard warriors and go after each other. She's going to have to deal with that. She's going to have to deal with talk radio. Will she be mentally strong enough to do it? Probably. She's won a World Cup. That World Cup team has gone through an awful lot and has really navigated a lot of challenges, internal and external. So for them, she's been there and done that. Is she well equipped to do it because she's been on a big national and world stage? Absolutely. That, to me, is a bigger challenge than kicking a football through an upright.
Yes, well said. I would predict that she would succeed and she'd be able to handle the mental challenge because of her elite soccer performance and being on that team that has dealt with the equal pay issues and has gotten a lot of U.S. attention on and off the field. So, you know, she would have my vote of confidence. And getting back to Hauschka, what's interesting about him is he played soccer in college at Middlebury. And so he has made that transition from soccer to football.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
And I knew he was a soccer player. Was he a football player and a soccer player? Or?
Yeah, he was soccer, and then he started football at D3, then he went D1, then he went to NFL. And he said that it took him about a year to really make the transition in terms of technique from kicking the soccer ball to kicking the football. And so that's why he volunteered and said, I'd be happy to help her. And it sounds like she is eyeing 2020 for a legit tryout and make a serious run at playing in the NFL. But, you know, the thing that he mentioned that might be her biggest challenge is, where is she going to get reps in a game? Because he was able to go through the minor league, so to speak, of D3 and D1 college before he had to kick in the NFL. She's going to have to jump right in. And
I guess. And wherever she goes, even if she was going Arena League or anything, CFL, everything is going to have some kind of a microscope.
Yeah, maybe she goes to the CFL. You're right. She might not start in the NFL. But the thing about kicking is, you in this day and age, you have to be close to 100%.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, not so much on extra points anymore, but these guys don't miss, and potentially gals, they don't miss from 40 to 49 anymore.
No.
I mean, take Matt Bryant, longtime kicker. I just heard the stats this morning. Last year, at the age of 43, he missed one kick for field goals. It was over 50 yards. He was 19 of 20 on the season, 4 of 5 over 50 yards, and he doesn't have a job. He's trying out for the Atlanta Falcons today.
Why would the Bears not just sign him?
Exactly. Bears and Vikings, you hear about multiple teams this spring who've had these kickers coming in a revolving door. And
new man on the Minnesota Vikings? Sorry. I don't know if you probably haven't heard that song. All right, keep going.
So, yeah, that's the point is, if Matt Bryant doesn't have a job and he went 19 for 20 last year, there is going to be a ton of pressure on her in her first job to perform well right out of the gate.
You would look at Matt Bryant making 19 or 20 and his only miss is over 50 yards. And I don't know if this were like a real world experience, because the NFL is not. I mean, the NFL makes its own rules based upon who's employed and who's not. And seemingly a lot of times it's arbitrary. But you look at the NFL, if it were a company and all of a sudden he came back and they had cleared out his desk and there was a box waiting for him and his performance reviews were good, and it was because he was older than, I'm going to say, 85, 90% of his counterparts, he might have an opportunity to sue.
Well, yeah, in the U.S., the age is 40. If you're over 40, you can sue for age discrimination.
So. What's your source, employment attorney?
my research.
Law degree, yes.
Yeah, so yeah, there's the 43-year-older.
I don't know. Would you take that case?
Yeah, if it was applicable, certainly. A 95% performance.
That's what I'm saying. It was 19 and 20.
And there's other people out there who are...
Eddie Pinero.
85.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely.
Or the Vikings Viking kicker.
It's a slam dunk. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So, I don't know. It's a slam dunk or a chip shot, depending.
Although it was the Vikings kicker who missed that chip shot in the playoffs
Blair Walsh.
A couple years ago. That was not good.
Exactly. It was the Blair Walsh project.
Oh, yep. I could see that one coming, too.
Yeah.
Oh, painful.
The Vikings have that history of that.
Yeah.
Of doink. And that's the Bears' history now, I guess. Maybe it's that entire division.
Yeah. The Bears double doink.
Yeah. Ay, Dios mío. Anyway. All right. Now that we're done talking about the NFL.
Should we do some college football?
We can.
Up the road at Dartmouth?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
You know what's funny is I have that college fantasy league that I'm in with a bunch of Stanford guys. It's, I think, 7 Stanford guys and me with my Community College of LA degree. And so all these guys are very intelligent, but to a man, they all can't stand Buddy Tevens because he was the Stanford coach and very notably stunk up the joint and left. And guys like Bill Walsh and David Shaw and Jim Harbaugh have proven that even though Stanford has very rigorous academic requirements, you can still win at Stanford if you're a good coach. David Shaw, to me, I would put him up against anybody as far as his ability to convert a lump of coal into a diamond. So that being said, Buddy Tevens took a lump of coal and just made a whole bunch of lumps of coal at Stanford and then came back to Dartmouth. And now apparently you sent me this glowing piece on ESPN about good old Buddy.
Yeah, he's making a name for himself in Hanover with some interesting techniques that you never know could revolutionize some aspects of football all the way up to the NFL. The most interesting one that got the headlines was what they've been doing in terms of tackling at Dartmouth. Back in 2011, Coach Tevens announced to the team and the staff that they were no longer going to tackle each other in practice.
The coaches and players tackle each other in practice?
Nobody associated with the program was going to tackle anybody else.
That was a good misplaced modifier, though. That was fun. The coaches, coaches and players were no longer going to tackle each other.
No more infighting. Yes. Guys, we're only tackling the opponent.
Like, God forbid you're walking with your lunch tray in the cafeteria and somebody just blindsides you and then your fruit cup goes everywhere.
It's an immediate flag.
Yep, exactly. Somebody get that wet floored little sandwich board and we got to clean things up. Continue.
So basically, they put those wet floor sandwich boards all over the practice field.
Yep.
So now you don't tackle each other. What you tackle is a robotic tackling dummy.
Yes.
They have these.
But at Dartmouth, they don't call them dummies.
What do they call
them? They're smarter than the rest of us.
Well, they call them MVPs.
Okay, there you
They're
go.
They're mobile virtual players.
Yep.
So what these MVPs do is.
You're the real MVP, Mom.
Is they.
Just one of those days.
They travel around the field at up to 18 miles an hour. Okay. And they are by remote control. So it's a robot that the coaches can push a button and it moves around the field and it's supposed to represent a player and the defense, that's what the defense tackles is the robot. And the whole idea is we need to minimize concussions.
Yeah.
We want our players on the field. And what really prompted this is one play in practice where they had a running back and a linebacker collide. They both got concussions. And so now Dartmouth is down 2 players after one play in practice. And Coach Stevens says, you know, I don't want this anymore. So they institute this new policy. Concussions on the team went down by over 50%. And despite the fact that they haven't been practicing tackling each other in practice, they've been successful on the field. In the last 5 years, they've won 76% of their games, which is the best in the Ivy League.
Yeah, it's his record is impressive. I can't wait until they implement those MVPs in the men's softball league, and we don't actually have to play. There are just things that run around in the outfield and catch fly balls, and some of them have bigger circles than others as far as where they can move to make a play. I think it's a revolutionary thing. I understand you only, and everybody has. Just like if you were to buy a car, some cars are going to last for 100,000 miles, some cars 200, some cars 50. Like, you just don't know when you buy the car how long the thing's going to last. And the same thing goes with any of us. I don't know how many throws I have in my arm. I don't know how many times, if I was a football player, I don't know how many hits I can take before I wind up with CTE. Some people have a lower number, some people have a higher number. I don't, and I'm pointing at myself right now when I say this, I'm not a doctor. All I'm saying is this is completely anecdotal evidence of watching players post NFL career and say, okay, how is it, like, who wins the good luck lottery that they don't have CTE after a long NFL career? And some guys do. And you don't know. There's no way to test for who's going to be susceptible to it yet. I know there's a lot of research being done in spite of the fact that some people would have you believe that that isn't a problem in the NFL. It is a problem in the NFL. The repeated hits to your head are a problem. Players are fast and strong. It is a problem. It's simple physics. Force equals mass times acceleration. Faster the players get, the stronger the players get, the more force they're going to exert when they make a tackle. And you only have so many times you can hit somebody straight on. So if you can create something that's going to allow your players to learn that skill better, but preserve what's encased within their skull. Awesome.
Well, that's exactly what his focus is. His motivation is, he did the math again and he figured, well, if we can reduce the number of hits for each player by thousands over the course of their career, we're drastically going to improve the chances that they avoid more concussions, avoid CTE. And that's what it's all about.
Yes. It did. I thought the hokey pokey was what it was all about. particularly for Ivy League players who, yeah, there are some. One is starting a quarterback for the Miami Dolphins now, Ryan Fitzpatrick. There are some who go on to long NFL careers, but many don't. And you hope that those players have the opportunity to put an Ivy League degree to good use and not suffer the after effects of way too many hits to the head. And, you know, I realize football is a rough game and it's not an easy game. And it's not like you see it enough where guys have played in the NFL and have pronounced limps after they're done. And there are enough of us who play in the BMSL and have pronounced limps after we're done.
Well, that's what happens when you have 10-inch grass that you're trying to deal with out in the outfield.
Truth. You know, but ultimately you want those guys who are doing that to have the best possible outcomes they can. And you don't want the price that they pay for a long NFL career to be lifetime debilitation. I don't know.
Yeah. And there has been some buy-in throughout the Ivy League. All of the teams have agreed that they're not going to tackle each other, players or coaches, during the season. So the other Ivy League teams, they'll still hit in spring practice, OTAs, all that stuff. During the season, everybody agrees, all right, we're not going to tackle in practice. Some of the NFL teams that have used these MVPs include the Cowboys and Steelers. So it's something that's gaining traction. And it'll be fun to see. Hopefully it'll decrease injuries. I mean, the quote that he said is something that you say about baseball. It's, you know, if we don't change the game now, we're not going to have a game down the road.
It's completely accurate. You look at our town and there's a lot of interest in youth football in this town, and there are a lot of kids playing it. Like, you go out to SAU Field on any given day when there's practice, there are 80 or 90 kids that are between the ages of 5 and 8. So football is strong here. Football is not strong everywhere else because there are a lot of barriers to entry. There's mom or dad saying, I don't want you to do that. There's the cost. It's not an inexpensive sport to play. There's the programs not being strong enough. There's the what has caused the program to be strong here, where kids are playing it and more kids are playing it because their friends are playing. The flip side of it also happens. If fewer kids are playing, then their friends don't play. And so if you don't fix those problems and fix I happen to believe if you take too many hits to the head, you will pay for it. There's no negotiation on it. Your brain can only take so much. And again, everybody's threshold is different, but there are enough people who believe that it is compromising the game. Football will have to do a job at the younger levels to convince people that that is not an issue. And if they can convince people that that's not an issue and maintain the strength of the game, like, I enjoy watching the game. I enjoy the chess match that goes along with it. But, you know, you also have to sit there when you watch a game, and I do. All right, what cost is any of this going on? God, that was a great hit. But at what cost? It's a challenge for the game, and it's something that they do need to fix. Otherwise, yeah, there won't be one.
Well, thankfully, the NFL is making changes to the helmets. That's an adjustment that's easier on some than others. You know, Antonio Brown's had some highly publicized disagreements with the helmet policy. But one of the big pieces of news recently that you wanted to talk about was another player who was done with the chess match, so to speak, Andrew Luck, not so much from head injuries, but just injuries all over his body, finally took a toll on him.
Yeah, and I would be – actually, I'm not even going to say this. He will not be the last one to do this exact thing, where you get to a point and you say, you know, Patrick Willis did it. There are a number of guys that have done it, where they get to a point where they're 28, 29, 30, and they say, you know what, this just isn't worth – like, I have enough money that – generations in my family are going to be able to enjoy the sacrifice that I've made. I don't need to keep going with this. And that's, you know, the point that was made. And, you know, you're reading last weekend about Andrew Luck and his choice to retire. When they have players go through the Wunderlich tests and the personality inventories and all of those sorts of things, they're really trying to catch — they being the NFL teams — are trying to catch the guys who might love the game, but also might kind of realize, wait a second, there's going to be a point in time when there's enough money in the bank and I have other interests that I love the game, but I'm not going to sacrifice every other aspect of my life for this game anymore. Luck won't be the last. And honestly, if I was 29 years old and had $50 million in the bank, it'd be hard for me to justify sticking around looking at some of the guys who have put in the time in the NFL and have had significant issues down the road.
Yeah.
And particularly considering his history.
Right. You're right. Others have done it. He's the highest profile player to have done it in his prime, quarterback who was set to make $400 million or more if he played another 10 years and, you know, got towards the age, not even to Tom Brady, but if he just played another decade, that's probably what he would have made.
Oh, yeah.
And so what's so surprising about it is how much money he left on the table. And of all the positions to play, the way they protect the quarterbacks now, that probably is the best place to be to try and avoid head trauma, right? And so that's what made it so shocking, is his age, the fact that he would make that much money in the future, the fact that they were a legitimate Super Bowl contender, you know, projected to win 10 and a half games, I think, so be right in the playoff mix. But, you know, then there was that tweet, I forget who it was, but who went down the list of his injuries.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
he's got a bad list.
I mean, he missed an entire year because of his shoulder. You know, then there was the one about, like, you know, his blow to his kidney. I mean, this recent thing with his ankle, Achilles, who knows what it is. But, I mean, all up and down his body, he's just taking a beating. And you know, so now you get people blaming the old general manager. Like, if you'd given a, if you'd put an offensive line in place that could protect him, maybe we wouldn't be having this discussion.
But yeah,
that's what happened. And, you know, Andrew Luck made quite a decision, and you're right. He won't be the last.
Yep. Man, I guess if you are an Indianapolis Colts executive or a fan, you might at this point think that your luck has run out.
It has.
All right.
It's Jacoby Brissett time.
I'll see myself out. Don't forget to tip your waitress. Thank you to everybody who joined us today. Andrew Hansen, Charlie the Dog. Thank you to everybody here at Bedford 105.1. Bill Jennings, Colleen Richardson, Harry Kozlowski for all their work. And, yeah, I guess that's it. So,
football next Friday night.
Football next Friday night. Have a wonderful Labor Day weekend. Whatever you're doing, be safe. You are listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1.